Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Dr. Michelle Cohen, and you are officially on the couch here, as you always are, on LA Talk Radio. The country's most irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk radio station. Right now, you're going to get shrinked, folks. Because I, Dr. Michelle, have one of the most amazing guests. One of my favorites, actually. I've had him on the show several times. Who's going to really inform you about a lot of issues around, you know, mental illness. You know, we're still coming out of the old ages here to try to clarify what's going on with a lot of people who suffer from many disorders. And I don't know. I don't know if you've ever thought to yourself, I'm losing it. Or I can't take the stress anymore. Or I can't take any responsibilities or sadness in my life anymore. I feel like I'm going crazy. Do you use that phrase sometimes? Well, as much as I particularly do not like using the C word, really, many of the people without chemical imbalances or clinical diagnoses have said to me that they are feel like they're going crazy. And most of us have had issues, or we're still working through issues from whatever, some sort of depression, anxiety, mood swings, and just difficult times in general. At some time or another throughout our lives. And I think it's an ongoing journey, and we're always learning, no matter what our age. But today I'm talking about understanding chronic mental illness and chemical imbalances, and a lot of the challenges that mental illness poses for patients and their families and healthcare professionals and our society in general. And, you know, no matter how strange some behavior may seem, mental illness can be understood if attention is paid. So everybody's story and life is unique, and we're really, you know, all more alike than you think, though. And we're linked by the richness of our shared human experiences. That's what we're going to find out about today. So if you've ever wanted to be a fly on the wall in a psychiatrist's office or in the hospitals or the clinics, and you'd like to learn more about the strange behaviors and thoughts and feelings of people who are coping with mental illness today, hopefully you're going to hear some stories that will really surprise you today about some real people that will amaze you. And hopefully demystify the subject while offering some hope for the future, especially if you or somebody close to you is suffering or trying to cope with a mental illness. And I encourage you guys to call in if you'd like, if you have any questions or comments for me and my guest, who I will introduce momentarily. The phone number here, 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815 here in beautiful downtown Los Angeles. Or if you'd like to email me, you're a little shy, you don't want to get your voice on the air, it's straighttalkdoc@gmail.com, straighttalkdoc@gmail.com. I really invite your questions or comments. So one of my favorite guests I've always had on the show is Dr. Mark Rubenstein. He's one of the best. He's on the couch again, talking about his latest book, Bedlam's Door, True Tales of Madness and Hope. Now, the doctor's a novelist many times, but most of his work is taken from real-life stuff that he's experienced. So he's not only a novelist, physician, psychiatrist. He was formerly a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at Cornell University Medical College, an attending psychiatrist at New York Presbyterian Hospital in New York City. He's the Paul Stevens Professor of Applied Investment Analysis at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. And, of course, he's best known for his work on derivatives and asset pricing. He's a superstar. What can I say? There's more and more accolades that I can share about him, but I really want to get to his latest book and talk more about it. And then also let you guys know how you can find out about how to get his fascinating book, Bedlam's Door, True Tales of Madness and Hope, and of course his other books that we'll talk about too. Dr. Mark Rubenstein, hello, how are you?
I'm fine, Dr. Michelle. How are you?
Oh, I'm well. I'm well. Sitting here in the 100-degree weather we're having on this lovely summer day in Los Angeles.
It's no better on the East Coast,
Michelle. Yep. I hear that. Well, thank you so much for joining us. As always, a pleasure to have you. You are an amazing writer and teacher and medical physician. So I really appreciate all you do for everyone, really.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for having me.
Well, that's always my pleasure. We're going to check out True Tales of Madness and Hope. And a lot of your books that I've read before, you know, they're novels, but they're based on nonfiction. I mean, they're based on true stories. This book really is about true stories and things that you have encountered along the way.
Yes.
you're really kind of sharing in each chapter a particular kind of mental disorder, a story about an individual who suffer from like PTSD and major depression, sexual issues. You've got bipolar disorder, OCD, other fascinating issues in here. So I'm just curious, why did you write this nonfiction book?
I have to tell you, Michelle, these stories and a number of others, which will probably be in Bedlam's Door 2 a year or two from now, have been percolating in my mind for many, many years, some longer, some shorter. Bottom line is really that in view of some of the things that have happened in the last few years, I suppose beginning with Columbine, but really reaching coming to a head
right.
with Sandy Hook in Connecticut and with the Orlando shootings and with other bizarre, horrific things invariably involving one kind of mental illness or disturbance of another. I really felt I wanted to share some of these stories because so many of these things that have happened that have been large in the news seem incomprehensible to us.
Right.
And as you put it so well, there is a unity to all of these things, and they can be understood if people pay attention. One of the things that's really disturbed me as a professional, I'm sure you feel the same way, is how little seems to be understood about mental
right.
illness and about psychology and psychiatry.
Yeah.
And you really see and hear this when there's something like a mass shooting, how people don't get it right.
Yeah.
And the bottom line for me is that I wanted to share these stories to show that no matter how seemingly bizarre, no matter how crazy or from another world something can seem, it can be understood if attention is paid, if time is devoted to understanding the person, and that there are remedies. And as you said so well, mental illness is one of the big challenges in our society, and to not only the patients and the people treating them, but to the families involved, and really to the entire healthcare delivery system.
Yes.
More money is spent and wasted on mental illness and locking people up than is on all the physical illnesses that there are out there in the hospital world.
Isn't that sad? I mean, it's really sad because there are, as you said, some amazing medicines and treatments today that can really help folks. So
There are, and you know, toward the end of the book, I detail some of the newest development. You know, one of the things that's always bothered me is that people who are anti-psychiatry, who don't believe as though it's a religion
right.
in psychology, who think it's just a bunch of gobbledygook and
right.
hogwash, they don't think. I remember I used to go to court and testify in forensic issues. They said, well, isn't a true doctor that of all medical specialties, psychiatry, psychology are the least scientific? And the bottom line really is that they're not at all unscientific. The realm of psychiatry and psychology have both expanded now into the world of neuroscience and cognitive science, and there's so much being accomplished now with new forms of treatment. Eventually, there will be gene therapy and immunotherapy and diagnostic testing that will predict whether or not you will respond to a specific medication. And if so, how you will respond to that medication, and which medication is most likely to cause the fewest side effects. And there will be medications and treatments involved that will have virtually no side effects. You know, one of the enduring fantasies about, let's say, for instance, ECT, derives from 1975 film with Jack Nicholson.
That's
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
I saw that the other day. That was so cool.
Yeah, everybody thinks that ECT is the way it was depicted in the film.
That's
it was 40 years ago, 50 years ago. But not anymore. It's vastly different now. Very effective.
And that's, you want to explain what ECT is?
Electroconvulsive therapy.
There you go.
It used to be that they put the person through a convulsion, that they woke up after the severe brain shock and couldn't remember anything, and that it would have permanent cognitive deficits attached to it, none of which is true anymore. They now use a far slower and a less powerful electropulse. It's done on what's called a unipolar basis on one side of the head, not the other. They now use muscle relaxants, so there's no convulsion of any kind, and there are virtually no after effects. Whatever happens in the way of an anterograde and retrograde amnesia is usually only for a few hours. A short course now of six treatments, and this is for refractory depressions, those that don't respond to medication and or psychotherapy. This can be so effective, it's hard to believe. Nobody knows exactly why it works. Nobody knows the mechanism of its success, but empirically, it works.
Yeah, there you go, and we'll take it, and it's been approved by the FDA, as has TMS, or transcranial magnetic stimulation. That's sort of the latest step, using a magnetic pulses, correct?
That's right, and there are no side effects. You get up and you walk out, and you in a couple of treatments, you can feel absolutely non-depressed, and you don't take any medication. You don't. Again, these are still in their early stages, and the magnetic treatment is really used in those cases where it's refractory to earlier attempts, but. There's a whole new horizon approaching, and with all of mental health care delivery. And by the way, in view of all of this stuff, studies still show that a combination of medical / physical treatments with psychotherapy is still the most effective means of treating virtually all mental afflictions.
Yes. It is. It really is. And it's fascinating, and I want to talk more about that and what's going on with that. By the way, in case you just tuned in here on LATalkRadio.com, you're on the couch with Dr. Michelle and my special guest today, Dr. Mark Rubenstein. He's written another fabulous book, and this is taken from real life in the clinic, in the hospitals. It's called Bedlam's Door, True Tales of Madness and Hope. And that's the good part of it, too, because there is hope for a lot of folks, and Mark and I were just talking about that. If you'd like to call in, guys, love to hear from you. You have questions or comments. You want to share stories with us about people you know or yourself, what you've suffered. The number here, 323-203-0815. Or you can email me, and I do have some questions coming in already. But that email right here to the station, straighttalkdoc@gmail.com, straighttalkdoc@gmail.com. I wanted to ask you, Mark, what is the most bizarre? I know there's a lot. So we can just cherry pick one of the most bizarre or severe mental disorders you have encountered in your work in hospitals.
There have been so many. It's an embarrassment of riches. I had to pick one. This is not necessarily the most severe, although, you know, if you ask any person suffering from any mental disorder,
be it
panic attacks, anxiety, depression, PTSD, that person will think he or she is suffering from the worst disorder on the face of the earth. So, you know, to some extent, it's subjective. I will tell you about a bizarre case I saw not too many years ago. It's not the most severe pathology, but it really had a severe limiting effect on this woman's life. Actually, she didn't come to see me. Her husband came to see me. He was at his wit's end, and this was in my private office. He didn't know what on earth he could do. His wife had developed what clearly from his description turned out to be an agoraphobia. That is a fear of leaving the house. The name, I'm sure you know, agoraphobia comes from the Greek words, agora meaning marketplace, phobia meaning fear of. It's generally considered to be a fear of wide open places, malls, crowds, etc. But it really is a fear of leaving what the person deems to be a safe place. Well, his wife had developed agoraphobia very soon after having given birth to their first child. So therein was an enormously important clue as to what was going on. She could no longer leave the house. And he came in for two or three sessions to tell me about this, but he couldn't really get her to leave the house to bring her to my to my office. And you know, he wanted to know, would I go to their home and see her there? I was seriously mulling this over when he came in for what I think was the third session. He said, it's gotten even worse now. She's not only in the house and refusing to leave, she won't get out of the bedroom.
Was
bedroom bound.
So
she had finally winnowed her life down to this small space, a 12 by 14 foot bedroom, and he would not leave. He was cooking, he was cleaning, he was working, he was doing what he could for childcare. He had to hire somebody to help. Finally, out of desperation, he dragged her to see me. I was able to convince her to take some medication, one of the SSRIs, which are approved by the FDA for dampening down phobic anxiety. And within 3 weeks, she was able, very tentatively, to begin leaving the house. And about 3 months later, I can't say she was cured, but she was asymptomatic and was then able to begin exploring the roots of what had kept her not only apartment-bound, but bedroom-bound. That's one of the most bizarre cases I ever saw. I frankly never encountered another patient who was confined to one room as though if she left, she would somehow, some terrible fate would befall her.
Wow, that is a fascinating story. And, you know, a lot of people don't, you know, understand how scary that, that fear is. And you know, a lot of us have had so-called or close to panic attacks. But the idea is you can't leave your home because you fear that you're going to lose it because of being out there in public. You know, so you may have a panic attack, you may faint and die, or you you may make a fool of yourself.
There's nothing worse than a panic attack if you talk with people who've really had severe panic attacks, especially those that come in series. They can come in waves, one after another after another, and these people literally fear that they are dying. Their heart feels like it's pumping out of their chest. They can't breathe. They sweat profusely. They begin trembling. They grow pale. Sometimes they have instant diarrhea. Sometimes they fall to the ground and they're afraid to move, and this can happen in a public place. They feel that they must be in a safe place, which invariably is home. And, you know, with a loved one or in the company of somebody with whom they're familiar. And this, needless to say, this is the most constricting, life-limiting kind of illness to have. People are literally afraid to leave their homes. They become homebound and isolated. And, of course, they fear the fear. They fear that they're going to have a panic attack out in public. And the fear of the fear is even worse than the fear itself. And, of course, it's sort of like swimming in concentric circles until you've created a whirlpool and down you go.
It is. It is just amazing. And I want to get to also, you know, one of the most common things I hear from my physician friends in the ER is people think they're having heart heart attacks. So they race to the ER, and it's basically a panic attack. They're having palpitations. Their blood pressure goes up. They're sweating profusely. They're out of breath. They think they're dying. So,
and they have chest pain, too.
Yeah,
chest
there
pain
you go.
And stomach pain, and they come in. Their fingers are tingling. Yeah. The area around the mouth is tingling. Pins and needles, that's due to hyperventilation.
Right.
Just breathing way too fast, and they're blowing off carbon dioxide, and it creates this sort of tingling feeling around the lips and the fingertips, and they truly think they are having a heart attack and dying.
Yeah, I hear you. Boy, it is just fascinating. Let's move on to some of the stories you talk about in your book here. And, you know, I think right now one of the most widely recognized mental disorders, well, it's depicted in the media in countless movies, starting back as far as 1978. Remember Deer Hunter?
Oh, yes.
PTSD. The PTSD that has gone on, and of course, with how our soldiers have suffered, individuals who've suffered horrific abuse growing up in environments or seen, experienced any kind of trauma in their life. And a lot of people are dealing with PTSD. So you share a fascinating story about this man born in Hungary. And he's living on Manhattan's Lower East Side, and he's found running down the Delancey Street. I know where that is. I know where that is. And he's ranting, "I'm king of the Puerto Ricans." What's going on with this guy? Why is he doing this, and why is he disrupting so many people? What's going on in his mind?
Well, he was not only running down the street and ranting at the top of his lungs, he was king, not president, but king.
Yes.
Of the Puerto Ricans, but he was throwing over trash cans, and he was summoning all the people to come out and to follow him as though he was the Pied Piper of Hamelin. What was going on with him is he was a man who had been working. He was not a young man. He was in his early 60s. He was working as a carpenter when he had an accident and fell about 15 feet from the roof of a private house on which he was working.
Right.
They were framing the house, and he fell and he broke some vertebrae in his back, and he could no longer work at his job as a carpenter. And there was a question as to whether he would have, his back would ever heal sufficiently to allow him to return to heavy carpentry work. And as I said, he was not a young man, so the whole healing process was going to be slow and arduous anyway. Well, I don't want to give too many spoilers, but I will tell you this. The onset of his symptoms occurred a number of days after he got out of the hospital following this injury. And his wife couldn't understand it, and she too had been born in Hungary. And it turns out that he was a Holocaust victim who had survived Auschwitz.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, he had. So talk about PTSD, but he didn't have PTSD from Auschwitz. He was liberated from Auschwitz and was placed in a DP, a displaced person camp, for a number of months. And eventually, he met his wife-to-be in the DP camp. She had been living with a family on a farm somewhere in Hungary and had managed to escape the Nazis. They eventually made their way to the United States. They were married, and he began working even through the language barrier. He was able to work because he was such a skilled carpenter.
Wow.
Well, I don't want to give away too much
no.
of the story, but
no.
his carpentry had, in essence, saved his life.
Yes.
It had enabled him to negotiate the horrific rigors of Auschwitz, where he lost his family, his neighbors, his entire town was decimated.
Right.
He survived. And when the carpentry was taken away from him, so came on the onset of his illness, of the PTSD, delayed by 40 years.
Whoa.
He had been asymptomatic for 40 years, but when he could no longer work, his post-traumatic stress disorder came to the fore and exploded to the surface and erupted, and he ended up in a mental hospital. I'm not going to tell you what happened after that because there's much, much more to this story.
And
the King of the Puerto Ricans is the first story in the chapter.
Yes.
I might add also, Michelle, as I know you know, after each story is what I called an afterword, where I do my best to explain not only the illness and its onset and severity and why it happened the way it did, although sometimes that becomes self-evident, but also some of the societal and social and medical and psychological issues involved. And, you know, some of the dilemmas this has created for government and for healthcare providers as well as families. So each story has an afterword. It's not academic at all. It's all very, I think, very readable.
Yeah, it's very
down to earth, and yet I think each reader comes away knowing a heck of a lot more about psychology, psychiatry, mental illness, and also is entertained.
It is. It's a fascinating read because you're unraveling the life stories of these people and what perhaps made them do the, and I hate to use the C word, but do the crazy things that they do, or what has caused, you know, a lot of their trauma, and the things that kind of we all fear. Whether we've experienced moments of meltdowns, panic attacks, depression, which we all have, fear that we are going crazy ourselves. So it's a fascinating compilation of stories. By the way, guys, if you just tuned in here, you're on the couch with Dr. Michelle, my special guest, Mark Rubenstein. He's written a fabulous book. It's called Bedlam's Door, True Tales of Madness and Hope, and that's exactly what they are. It really challenges... It depicts a lot of the challenges that mental illness poses for patients and their families and, of course, healthcare professionals, our society in general, you know, as evidenced by all the violence and the killings and the people who go out there in society and hurt others. It's very scary. But it really kind of points out that no matter how strange some behavior may seem, mental illness can be understood if attention is paid. So I think it's really fascinating. The only mental illness that I always have a hard time coping with, for me, Mark, and I don't work with this population because I choose not to, but it's the antisocial personality disorder or the sociopath, which are sort of different in a way, types of, there's one, I guess, goes hand in hand with the other, but... These are the people who are, I believe, if they're not psychotic, right, having a psychotic episode where their voices are saying, these people are the devil and you must murder them. Or the voices, the hallucinations, where they're saying, you know, you need to save the world because you are God. But just downright evil people. Why are there such downright evil people? What is that about? Can it be cured?
That's a question I think has bedeviled human society since it first began in caves. Why are some people just pure evil? Let me just parenthetically add in that not all the stories in Bedlam's Door are about psychotic and raving people.
Yes.
In fact, about half of them are people like you and me who
are psychotic and raving.
And who are not, to use the word crazy, but who have problems and who, for one reason or another, succumbed to them and became very symptomatic, whether it's someone who developed the acute onset of OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, couldn't stop cleaning her apartment, or someone else who just couldn't stop seeing a woman because they were having a wonderful sexual life together, but it was very, very dangerous, and he was really treading on thin ice by doing it, and he couldn't stop what he was doing. He just it was too alluring. So not all of those of the stories are about really sick, fragile people. But to get back to sociopaths, sometimes called psychopaths, nobody really knows what it is. It may be a combination of nature and nurture, that is, biology as well as early upbringing. Nobody has really been able to definitively tease apart what it is that makes for a sociopath. But these are people who are generally viewed by the mental health community as not having anything in the way of a valid conscience, unable to feel remorse about anything they say or do.
I'm losing you a little bit, Mark. We're having a little bit of trouble here with our phone connection, but go ahead and I'll tell you when it gets too bad and I may call you back.
These are people who can't really make a warm, caring connection to others, who use others, who have an intense narcissism about them and see the world in terms of what they can get out of it and everyone else be damned. And as I said before, they're people who, for the most part, seem to lack a conscience and who oftentimes are very good at manipulating others and can even appear to be ingratiating,
right,
and oftentimes attract other people, much to those other people's detriment.
Right.
Exactly how and why this kind of personality constellation forms is not really understood very well by scientists, neuroscientists, or by the mental health community.
Yeah.
But they are out there, and some of them are violent people. Others of them are just social psychopaths or sociopaths who have no problem embezzling or cheating people out of money or stealing or engaging in other antisocial. That's the other name for them, antisocial personality disorder.
Yeah.
They engage in what we view generally as antisocial behavior without having any sense of wrongdoing or remorse for what they have done.
Right, right. And that's, you know, that whole, there's that huge amount of narcissism, sense of entitlement, and, you know, there's just like a chip missing. There's an empathy, conscience chip missing in
there's
in
an empathy gap, yes.
It's amazing, yeah.
Yeah, or as they say in medicine, it's there's a myopia or there's a lacunae, you know, a big hole in the personality, you know, that most of us have to a significant extent. We filled that hole. I mean, if I say something that really causes another person shame or harm, geez, I feel terrible about it afterwards. You know, if I don't apologize, I'll be haunted by it.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah,
of course.
I think most of us are that way, but these people, they don't care.
Right, exactly. And by the way, guys, in case you want to get a little more involved and find out more about this, within Dr. Rubenstein's book, Bedlam's Door, there is a story about Aaron J. It's about working in a prison ward with inmates who are psychopathic killers and others. But Aaron J. will be a surprise to you as well. I'm just giving him a little bit of a tease. That's all we're going to say.
Yeah, I learned Aaron Jay, who is a prisoner at Fishkill Correctional Facility, a medium prison facility, correctional facility in upstate New York, where I went to evaluate him. I was asked to examine him and comment on whether or not he was sane and was capable of presenting himself as his own attorney. He wanted to represent himself pro se because he was suing the state of New York, who were his captors. He was a prisoner of the state of New York for armed robbery, but he was suing them because he claimed that the prison air and the ductwork in the prisons had caused a terrible inflammation of his lungs and had caused him to develop asthma. And he was, and as a citizen of the United States, he had the constitutional right to sue. That's guaranteed in the Constitution. They wanted to know if I could send it. And he was his own attorney. He was acting pro se. And he had filed what's known as a bill of particulars, which is a fancy legal way of saying a complaint, which was filed with the New York State Supreme Court, located in Brooklyn, because that's where he had been arrested.
Right.
And they wanted to know, was he competent to represent himself, and two, was he psychotic? That is, was he insane? Was he deluded and imagining this kind of thing? Because if he was, the defendant, namely the state of New York, would make a motion for summary judgment that this is the product, his complaint was the product of a delusional state of psychosis. And my task was to interview him in the bowels of a maximum security block in Fishkill Correctional Facility.
Yeah.
And I learned from Aaron certain things that I will never forget. Here it is. I can't tell you how many years later. And I'm talking about him right now.
Right. Exactly. Wow, you have such a fascinating job. Just amazing, Dr. Rubenstein. Speaking about, this was a good one. I think I like the story about Joey P. That's how Joey P. talks, huh? I found that one of the most compelling stories that you wrote about was him. Well, for personal reasons, because I choose not to work with individuals who've committed crimes or been involved in criminal gangster work and things like that. It's just a little scary. So I was fascinated about how you had to tell him that you couldn't treat him anymore because of your extreme fear.
Dr. Michelle, I must tell you that long before Dr. Melfi made her appearance on the television screen in The Sopranos,
right?
I was in Dr. Melfi's situation.
I'm talking about
mid-70s. That's where this story comes from.
Oh, my God.
Joey came to see me on the referral from an internist who I knew from my internship days. And Joey had a big problem dealing with his father. His father was a very tough guy, a rough-hewn individual who had been born on the other side in Italy.
Yeah.
And I knew right away when I looked at Joey that, you know, he was from Brooklyn and he spoke in a certain way. He dressed a certain way.
Right.
I knew that he was working for his father, and I knew that there was a certain taint
sure.
to him. But I didn't think too much of it. I guess I was a young psychiatrist, and I needed patients. I had to build a practice, and he was a really nice guy, a sweet guy, and very ingratiating, not necessarily psychopathic or sociopathic, but I liked him. I was from Brooklyn originally, and his street patois reminded me of my own upbringing.
Right.
I knew a few guys, you know, I knew guys who knew guys, you know,
kind
of thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, we get into a discussion of him and his father, and he intimates to me that, you know, he's in the family business, and it's not such a great thing. He's getting picked on by his father and humiliated in front of the other business partners and blah, blah, blah. And he finally says to me, you know, we're in some other businesses too, construction and garbage hauling, right out of Tony Soprano.
Right.
You know? And this goes back to 1975, I believe.
Yeah.
And he comes in after a few weeks of once-a-week sessions and doing counseling, and he's developing some insight that he's very dependent on his parents. He comes in, he sits down, he says, Doc, you want to know something?
Uh-oh.
You want to know who clipped Carmine Galenti? Well, my jaw dropped because only about 5 days earlier, Carmine Galenti, a mob boss, had been clipped in an Italian trattoria in Brooklyn on Knickerbocker Avenue.
Mm.
Three guys came in with shotguns and pistols and blew Carmine Galenti away along with his two Sicilian bodyguards.
Oh.
And the pictures had been all over the Post and the news. It was even in the New York Times, which in those days didn't have these sensational kinds of photos.
Right.
Dead Carmine Galenti.
Oh.
Lying down, his head nooked up against a low-lying wall.
Oh, my God.
A bullet hole in his left eye.
Right.
And blood all over the place. And in his clenched teeth was a still-smoking cigar.
Oh!
And I realized suddenly that this kid wanted to make me privy to mob information.
Well, how
and it
did...
dawned on the jerk that I was for the first time that... Who knows what his father and his associates think Joey is telling me.
Right.
And my life could be in danger. And I don't want to tell you what happened after that.
Yeah, it's a good story. It's a good story.
But I really thought I stood a very good chance of getting clipped.
Yes. No, it's really true. I mean, we'll just sort of let you read the book for yourself, guys. It's called Bedlam's Door, True Tales of Madness and Hope, Dr. Mark Rubenstein. It's a fabulous read, and it's true about, you know, his experiences in hospitals as a psychiatrist and also clinics in his private practice office in New York. Really talks about a lot of, you know, illnesses that he has seen and some normal reactions to life situations that we all share and have all dealt with as well. It's not about necessarily severe disorders throughout the book, but there are things that are, to me, just fascinating stories that have really taken place. And I love the way that you explain at the end of each chapter, Mark, what really was going on here. And you also help families understand, lovers, you know, coworkers, sort of understand what's going on with these individuals who are suffering with these stressors and disorders in their life. So I really liked it.
You know, the host of issues that arises is amazing, because among other things I had to deal with Joey, that we just talked about, was what was my ethical and legal obligation, if any, to what do I do? Do I call a lawyer?
You can't.
Do I call the police?
You can't.
Do I ignore this? I didn't know what to do. And, of course, the story goes on about what happened after that. But I was really faced with a therapist's dilemma with what were my ethical legal obligations, and I had to go seek expert help because I didn't know what on earth to do.
Oh, exactly. That is
and
very scary.
That I feared that if I did anything, I'd be opening myself up to getting clipped.
No, that's exactly right. I've been privy to certain information in my private practice, and I know where certain people are going who know some information, and they really want to tell someone. And I say, just stop where you're at right here. Because I really cannot allow myself to hear this. It's not really my right to know this, and I actually had to refer this individual to someone who really specializes in working with antisocial and sociopathic behavior, and also gangsters.
the issue really ultimately boils down to. What does the confidentiality between patient and therapist really come down to in the end? Does confidentiality, if any place, end? And where does the public's right or the victim's, potential victim's right to know what's going on supersede the confidential relationship between therapist and patient?
Right, exactly. You also have a fascinating story about one of the most, I think, talked about disorders in the world is bipolar disorder. You know, a lot of people now, of course, in media, you know, they can use that as excuses, I guess. I have bipolar disorder. I have mood swings. You know, I have a little chemical imbalance. I kind of need the help. And it's a fascinating disorder because a lot of people don't understand it. So there's a great story in your book, Bedlam's Door, about someone who suffers, a couple of people actually, but someone who is suffering from bipolar disorder. It's a horrific chemical imbalance to have to cope with, especially if you have bipolar disorder 1. Can you share some information for listeners just briefly about what they might understand is going on?
Again, nobody knows the precise mechanism by which bipolar disorder exerts itself, but it is a mood disorder, meaning it's a disorder in a sustained emotional sense of how a person feels.
Right.
In bipolar 1 disorder, which is the most severe kind, the person can have alternating moods of elevated, exhilarating moods with intermittent episodes of depression, or they can have just elevated moods or just unipolar depression after depression after depression.
Right.
The most dramatic ones involve mania, which is the elevated mood. You know, the interesting thing is that it was discovered many, many years ago that a certain few communities in Eastern Europe had absolutely no evidence of bipolar, of what used to be what is now viewed as bipolar disorder.
Right.
And upon further analysis, they discovered that there was a high content of lithium in the water, in the springs feeding the water sources in these communities.
Huh.
And, you know, nobody really knows exactly how mood-stabilizing drugs, such as the lithium and some of the other non-natural compounds that have been formulated by pharmacy corporations, how they truly work, but they dampen down. By the way, most manic patients, you know this, I know you know this, most manic patients, they don't want to lose their mania. They love it. They feel so exhilarated, so high. They feel that they are on top of the world.
Sure.
And when they become what we call euthymic, that is when they're no longer manic and flying high, they feel terrible. They don't they don't enjoy their lives the way they do when they are on a manic high.
Right.
I once had a patient who, in the midst of a manic high, went out and bought tremendous amounts of furniture for thousands upon thousands of dollars and went to the local department store and just bought everything that that she fancied when she saw it on the spot. Some days later, when it was delivered, the furniture was so huge it couldn't fit through the doorway. So she called a contractor to come and tear down the doorway so they could get the furniture in.
Oh, dear.
And, these are, so help me, these are true stories.
Sure.
You know, truth is indeed sometimes stranger than fiction.
That's so true. And, you know, it's again, a tough disorder, and my heart goes out to a lot of people who have all sorts of chemical imbalances. And my hat's off to you for being so compassionate and informative in your book, Bedlam's Door, True Tales of Madness and Hope. Dr. Mark Rubenstein, he's been an amazing influence in the world of psychiatry. Novelist, physician, psychiatrist, a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at Cornell University Medical College, attending psychiatrist at New York Presbyterian Hospital in New York City. The accolades go on, of course. And you're best known for your work on derivatives and asset pricing, too, which is amazing.
Well, I wish that were true, Michelle. That's another marker.
Oh, I had you know what? I had just pulled this up, and I went, that is the other mark.
Yeah.
God bless you, and I'm sorry. I thought, wow, you're doing so many things. But
I did graduate initially with a degree in business administration before I went in the Army, and in the Army I was assigned to a medical unit, and that's how I developed my interest in medicine, and I went back to college and then got to medical school and became a psychiatrist, but I am not an expert on derivatives.
I'm so sorry. I apologize for that, and that's my bad, and we're going to edit that out in the in the archives. So, Mark, you've written so many books, though. Let's go back and correct actually what you have done with all of the books you've written. And there's so many, guys. So I just want you to, you know, be able to check out as many of these as you can. We're talking about his latest, Bedlam's Door, True Tales of Madness and Hope. We've been talking about it throughout the show today, and if you would like to re-listen to the show, it'll be available up in the archives tomorrow, or you can get his book. What is the best place to get your book, Mark?
Frankly, the best place, in my opinion, the quickest and easiest, is on Amazon. It will be available for Kindle as an e-book on Monday.
Monday. Good.
Yes, this coming Monday, the 15th. It will be available on in paper on September 1st. That's the real publication date, but it's you can pre-order it now, and Kindle will deliver it. And it will come out eventually in bookstores after the 1st of September. But really, you know, I hate to, I love bookstores, and I read paper as well as on Kindle.
Sure.
But typically, Amazon sells it for the least. You know,
it's great.
The money deals are on Amazon, which is why Amazon's taking over the world.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being an amazing guest, as always. It's a shame we couldn't get to so many of the chapters and, you know, fascinating case stories that you share in your book, but this will only tantalize listeners to go get it and read more. So it's always a pleasure to have you, Mark. Take good care of yourself, and looking forward
Michelle.
To Bedlam's Door 2.
Oh, that'll be coming in about a year and a half.
Oh, great.
First there's a novel, and then Bedlam's Door 2, you know, there are hundreds of stories to tell. There are
great.
As many stories as there are people.
That's
you remember the old Naked City?
Yes!
Dating myself.
Yes.
Remember, there are 8 million stories in the Naked City. Well, you know, there are as many stories, all of them interesting.
That's right.
As there are patients.
That's
what I've always loved about psychology and psychiatry. You can have 100 patients all suffering from depression.
That's right.
But each one of them has a unique story and a different pathway by which they arrived at depression.
Oh, that's perfectly said, Mark. Thank you for your genius and for giving so much to everyone and helping us all. We'll talk soon.
Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, guys. And of course, if you missed some of the show today and you want to find out more about Mark's book, Bedlam's Door, True Tales of Madness and Hope, you can find it at Amazon. I'll have the archives up for you and information right after the show. Thanks for listening, and do take care of yourself first, and then you'll be great for others. That's the way it works. This is Dr. Michelle. Have a great week, and I'll talk to you next week with more informative and great stories about how to help you on the couch. Bye-bye.
Flashing red.